Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
Not long ago, we ventured to Martha's Vineyard to visit a legendary lady.
Oh. Hello.
Welcome to the Charles W. Morgan.
Thank you.
The Morgan is a whaling ship, a wooden one, the last of her kind on Earth.
Wow.
Something else, huh?
It's beautiful.
Yes.
That gravelly voice belongs to Captain Kip Files.
Come on, I've got a cold.
You sound great, though. You sound,
raspy.
Sound salty.
Files is standing on deck in the shadow of one of the Morgan's three mighty wooden masts, looking nothing like a pirate, more like an old hand who's realizing a boyhood dream. Files unfurled his first sail at the age of 5, and now he's the 22nd captain of the Morgan. America's whaling fleet once numbered more than 2,700 vessels. The Morgan was built and launched from New Bedford in 1841, at the height of that era. She sailed on 37 voyages to just about every corner of the earth in search of whales. They're now, of course, a protected and beloved animal, but Files says that very fact makes the Morgan's complicated history that much more important. Standing on board this ship, he says, gives us a glimpse into the brutal, bloody effort that went into America's rise as a commercial power in the 19th century.
Well, I mean, think of the opportunity it is to sail a vessel like this. Someone that fought in the War of 1812 could have helped build it. Someone that was in the Civil War could have sailed it. You know, I mean, just goes to the history. Her historical connection to this country is unparalleled with anything afloat right now. In the commercial aspect, now that we have the wonderful Constitution, that's a military vessel. This is a commercial vessel. This vessel represents growth and wealth. This vessel paid taxes so you could build a vessel like the Constitution.
And like the USS Constitution at the Charlestown Navy Yard, the Morgan is also a National Historic Landmark. She's undergone a lengthy and extensive refurbishment that's allowed her to sail from Mystic Seaport in Connecticut to Newport and Martha's Vineyard, then on to New Bedford. The Morgan will eventually make its way to Boston in July. And let me tell you, the ship really is breathtaking. The woody scent of freshly cut planks wafts across the deck. She's 113 feet long, stem to stern, and fully rigged, the Morgan is capable of carrying 13,000 square feet of sail.
But right where we're standing right now, if you look around the ship, what do you see all around you?
I see a lot of, well, a landlubber would call them ropes.
That's
but
right.
I see a lot of lines.
That's exactly
everywhere.
Right.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of feet of line, thick as baseball bats, both soaring overhead and, in holding down gear, in elegant, complicated knots. We spent much of the day with Matthew Stackpole, official ship's historian for the Charles W. Morgan.
All these lines have a purpose. Everyone does a function with the sail. And you know that old expression, learning the ropes? That's what the sailors had to do. They had to learn all these ropes, and they had to know what they did, and they had to be able to find them in the night. So learning the ropes was not an abstract thing. You really had to do it. But that's one of the great things about the ship being set up like this, because people can see all of the gear that was necessary to drive these ships.
And Stackpole says America's 19th century whaling fleet was driven long and driven hard, more than 14,000 voyages under sail.
And who was Charles W. Morgan?
Charles W. Morgan was the principal owner, that means investor, in the ship. He owned 50% of it. But as an example of how the capital from whaling had an impact on the whole economy, he was also invested in textile mills. He owned a spermaceti candle-making factory. He was invested in iron foundries. He was invested in railroads. All the growth of the country at that point in the 19th century, those aspects of it were partially fueled by the money that came out of whaling.
Right, because, I mean, the oil that was coming from the whales was, I mean, it's basically like the oil that we're getting out of the ground today.
Well, you know, the quest for energy, that's one of the things we think about this ship. It's contemporary. It's relevant today because there are some issues that we're still wrestling with as to how do we respond to the search and need for energy.
So what was a typical voyage like?
It's really interesting. The voyages at that time from New Bedford, and before that from Nantucket, were typically around Cape Horn to the Pacific. They first started in the Atlantic, and then in the late 1700s, whale ships started to get around to the Pacific. They were pursuing the sperm whale. So a typical voyage, her first voyage lasted 3 years, 3 months, and 27 days, in which case she went across the Atlantic, down around Cape Horn, up along the equator, finally made her way up to the Gulf of Alaska, the Kodiak Ground, as they called it, back along the coast of North and South America, around Cape Horn and back home.
I am still amazed that ships of this size would regularly round the horn.
It's amazing. I mean, the thing about this ship is, it was the product of 150 years of experience, so everything had been refined. We think of high-tech today. This doesn't look high-tech, but when she was built, she represented all the knowledge of those 150 years before her. So she was functionally driven. Her design was formed by function, and she was designed to be able to do this. She was designed to be able to sail. She was designed to be a place where people could live, and she also was designed to be able to carry 90,000 gallons of oil. She was a tanker as well as a sailing vessel.
When someone sighted a whale,
yes,
what happened then?
The lookout would spot a whale, yell to the deck, "Thar she blows," or "Thar blows." They would lower one of these whale boats. This ship carried five whale boats and a crew of six in them. And then they would harpoon the whale. And this is something that a lot of people don't know, is that they harpooned the whale. That didn't kill the whale. That just attached the whaleboat to the whale. The first thing that might happen is the famous Nantucket sleigh ride, where the whale would race away because it's been stuck with this sharp thing, you know, and they would sometimes be pulled for miles, sometimes over the horizon. Or sometimes the whale would sound or dive. And they had to have about 3,000 feet of line with them in the whaleboat and whale tubs to let it out and get it back in.
3,000 feet of line in those little boats?
Yeah, in these whale tubs that they had. The final killing of the whale was it was not abstract, it was very intimate in the sense that the whaleboat had to get very close to it. And they took another implement called a lance, which is a real sharp one there, a long, skinny blade, and that was designed so that they would try to puncture a lung or a major artery. And so that's how they killed the whale. So that now we have a dead whale. It may be the ship is a long way away. They start towing it back. It weighs a ton of foot. They tie the whale alongside with the tail forward. And right over here was the cutting-in area. And they had huge tackle up in along the mainmast. They would hook a big hook into it, and they would take the blubber off the whale, similar to the way that we would peel an orange today. It literally would peel off. And they would take pieces that weighed about 1,000 to 2,000 pounds up, they were called blanket pieces, lower them into this hold behind me where they were cut into smaller pieces, then worked back up on deck where they were cut up even more, and put in these iron tripods on the ship where they were essentially rendered or melted, and that's how they got the oil out of it.
You know, it's so interesting to be here on board this vessel now, knowing all the history that that it encapsulates, and to think that, I mean, even though it's not all original, but being on the same ship where whales were brought in, because now we're living in an era where the idea of whaling is so anathema.
It is, that's right.
So
that's right.
I just wonder why you think it's important to know the story of the Morgan.
It's a great question. Obviously, today we have a whole different view of whales and what they are and what we should do to protect and preserve them. The reason for something like this to be remembered is not to romanticize or to celebrate or to demean what it did. It's to remember it. And the reason for history is to improve today and tomorrow. So some of the things that this ship didn't accomplish, exploration and discovery, technological development, entrepreneurship, the spirit of American enterprise, that's all pretty amazing. The fact that there was a finite number of whales in the 19th century wasn't even in their imagination. So what do we need to think about in terms of our potential impact on the world around us, whether it's the oceans or the air? What about energy? How do we solve our quest for energy? When whaling ended, the quest for energy didn't. There were just other alternatives. So what we like to say is the ship's cargo today is history. It's not oil anymore. And it's to bring attention to some of these things that are worth thinking about and considering.
Another thing I find so remarkable about the story of this ship is that, you know, it's a New England vessel that went all over the world.
That's right.
It's very much sort of a how New England projected itself around the world in the 19th century.
It's true. This vessel represents an industry that was, first of all, the first global industry that America, first as a colony. The vessels that were in the Boston Tea Party had gone to London with a cargo of whale oil, and they brought tea back. But the market was international. Where they had to go to get the whales was international. It was a global industry, and so people from here. It was the opposite of parochialism. I mean, these folks Thomas Adams Norton, the first captain, was a whaling captain for four different voyages and had been in whale ships. He'd been all over the world. His home in Edgartown, he had things he'd brought back from all over the world. So there was a sense of different cultures and communities. It's just very different. We think we're so cool today. These folks had been out there and seen things and brought stories home that nobody knew about. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. What's your favorite thing about being on board the Morgan?
My favorite thing about being on the Morgan, to me, that she is alive again. You know, we started out with a restoration, and we have a resurrection in a way. I had the honor of sailing on her from Newport to here, and to feel her alive again, under sail, moving, because it's the soul of a ship, and this ship has introduced over 20 million people to the history of whaling at Mystic Seaport, and will continue to do that. But we bring another whole dimension to it now, because before we weren't sailing 10 days ago, there was no one alive in America or anywhere who had sailed on a whaling ship. Because she's the real thing, she can very dramatically bring to mind both the history she represents and the questions we want people to talk about. So it's dramatic. So that's two favorite things, I guess, isn't it? I snuck that in. I didn't mean to.
Oops. That's quite all
that's
right.
That's what happened. So.
Well, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Matthew Stackpole is the ship's historian for the Charles W. Morgan, the last wooden whaling ship in the world. We spoke to him at Vineyard Haven on Martha's Vineyard. The Morgan is currently docked in New Bedford, and on July 18th, she sails to Boston and will be berthed alongside the USS Constitution at the Charlestown Navy Yard. And by the way, Anthony, you know how Stackpole mentioned Thomas Adams Norton, Martha's Vineyard native and the first captain of the Morgan?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that one of Norton's good friends, Captain Valentine Pease, I also learned this when I talked to Stackpole. Pease sailed out of New Bedford in 1841, the same year and place that the Morgan was built, and on his ship he had a crew member by the name of none other than Herman Melville.
That's remarkable. Truly remarkable. All right, stay with us. Coming up, a lot more coming up. Newton native and comedian Jonathan Katz. He's got a particular sense of humor, a cult following, and a new show coming up in Boston. Stick with us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.